Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Professor Rich Savin-Williams. Savin-Williams is Professor of Clinical and Developmental Psychology and Chair of the Human Development Department at Cornell University. He is the author of several books, including the recently released The New Gay Teenager, published by Harvard Press. Welcome to the show, Rich.
Thank you for inviting me.
Listen, before we begin to discuss your book, I just want to briefly touch on the fact that you're considered a pioneer in the study of sexual minority youth, and I want to know what prompted you to get into that field.
Well, one reason probably is because there wasn't hardly anyone else studying the issue of gay youth. So for me, it was one of those things where I saw an opening. I'd always been interested both sort of professionally and professionally, so it was, the field was wide open. Almost anything I did was publishable and could be easily construed as a contribution because there was just very little known at all mm-hmm. about youth with same-sex attractions.
Mm-hmm. Well, were the people that were basically what era are we talking about, the 70s?
Well, the first study was conducted in the 70s. I was just getting my PhD in 77, so mm-hmm. I was certainly not the original person who mm-hmm. was investigating these issues. But shortly thereafter, in the mid-80s, we began to be very interested, several of us. Most of the individuals, though, were interested in sort of the clinical, medical aspects of youth with same-sex attraction. So they were concerned, this is sort of pre-AIDS, so they were mm-hmm. certainly concerned with STDs, the issue of drinking, of homelessness, and prostitution. So that was sort of the first understanding about these youth, and mm-hmm. obviously many were not very happy.
Well, were a lot of people who were exploring these issues not gay themselves and were coming with preconceptions probably?
It's difficult to know. I would say, though, a fair number were gay themselves, but I think the bias was very, very clear, mm-hmm. and that was the interest was not on sort of the basic developmental milestones or social relations or personality development. It was really the focus was on their problems, and really calling clinicians and helping professionals to provide resources, services to these youth because they were very needy.
Mm-hmm. So in your new book, The New Gay Teenager, you've made some seemingly startling new discoveries, one being that youth, whatever their sexual feelings or experiences, seem to be defying the idea of labels, resisting specifically being called gay. Let's talk about that. Were you surprised by this?
I was very surprised and at first not very happy because I thought those of my generation, I'm 55, very concerned with gay rights and getting individuals to identify early and to be out and proud and in the streets and working for legislative rights and gay rights and feminist rights and so forth. So it would seem as if the least that the young people could do would be to continue the fight. And it seemed to me that the major part of that was first to be out and proud, mm-hmm. and to be out meaning to define yourself as gay mm-hmm. and or lesbian or bisexual, and then using that as a springboard for social action. Well, what has happened, it appears to me, from the research that I've looked at, both my own and what other people have gathered, is that there is a hesitancy now to define young people to define themselves in sexual terms, so that they say, there are a lot of things about me in my life, you know, I write poetry, I play baseball, you know, I do these various things, I'm a son, I'm a daughter, and yes, I do have a sexuality, but that's not the first thing that you should know about me in order to understand me. Mm-hmm. So there is some resistance to mm-hmm. sort of saying, oh, I'm a lesbian. Now that's all you need to know.
So you didn't construe this to be just youth in general being unsure of who they actually even are.
No. It's not mm-hmm. confusion. I think that's mm-hmm. That is the point which some people might sort of say, oh, these are just confused youth. Mm-hmm. No. These are not confused youth. They clearly know what they are attracted to. They clearly know what they desire. And I would say a fair number of them feel very comfortable with that. They're in their peer group is accepting in many ways of same-sex sexuality. It's not such a big deal. Mm. So that's not the critical element for their mm. identity.
All the work that the foremothers and forefathers did for the gay movement, it seems like we still haven't gone beyond that label of sexuality, because I think of us as having created a gay culture, and I guess young people today still think of it as a definition of sexuality. Is that right?
Well, they don't want a gay culture.
Ah.
They want to be a part of mainstream culture.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Now, clearly there are some youth who want to be a part of the counterculture, the gay culture, to be the outsiders, to be the rebellious ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very much in favor of them, and I think we ought to allow them to do whatever it is that they feel like they need to do to assert their strength and their power. But the vast, vast majority of kids with same-sex attractions, you know, they want their SUVs, they want their wives or their husbands, even if same-sex other, they want their normal careers. They don't want to be that involved. And I'm not, as an older person, I'm not here saying, no, mm-hmm. you have to. You,
right,
we fought for you, you have to fight for the mm-hmm, next generation. Mm-hmm. It's not up to my generation to tell young people what they ought to be doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How did you conduct this research? Did you actually do interviews and so on?
I did extensive interviews with young people, and then I also gathered some data, looked at some secondary data analysis, and I've looked at other people's research to sort of sort through what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the piece that always sort of intrigued me early on, and that is that when you look at the literature, traditionally in most high schools, or even when you get very good samples of high schools, representative high schools, whatever, you can get 2-3% maximum of youth saying they're gay, lesbian, or bisexual.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know, and everyone else knows, that there are far more than 2-3% of young people who have same-sex attractions.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, you know, where are the other youth? Where are they? Why are they not identifying as gay, lesbian, bisexual? I think before we used to just think they were sort of delayed or they were confused.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, what was the key element for me was that I saw a study that indicated that even though 2-3% identified as LGB, what you really find is that 2-3 or 4 times that many will say that they have same-sex or romantic attractions. So clearly, they know that they have same-sex attractions or keep falling in love with members of the same sex, and yet they were not identifying. So then the question is, are those different youth than are those who identify as LGB? And that was sort of the takeoff for my ideas and for my book to say, hey, look, there are these two populations, and they may be quite different.
Hmm. Did you find differences in cities and in rural areas as well?
I haven't really done that kind of sampling, but it strikes me that a number of my kids were actually from upstate rural areas in New York State.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying New York is representative of Kansas or Missouri,
mm-hmm.
But I think the key element is that I would realize it certainly is more difficult to identify in the Midwest, the red states. But on the other hand, here you have kids living in seemingly safe environments, and they still don't identify as gay, lesbian, or bisexual, even though they have gay-straight alliances in their schools,
yeah.
They have supportive teachers, they have state laws that protect them.
Mm-hmm.
You would think that they would be just really way out there identifying right and
mm-hmm.
left and
mm-hmm.
probably the 10-15% that there are of same-sex attracted youth.
Mm-hmm. What, do you have any conclusions about why this has happened? Why this sea change?
I don't know. I would attribute it to the fact that their culture, youth culture, is increasingly accepting of same-sex sexuality.
And what do you mean by youth culture? Are you talking about
what
age? What's the age group?
We'll say, you know, 12 to 18. That's
okay.
Basically what I'm talking about.
Okay.
They all are watching the same MTV programs, the same Fox stations, the same sort of they're seeing the same movies, they're reading the same books. So I think there is a way in which they have come to realize that their feelings, which people of my generation could hide from themselves for decades,
mm-hmm.
it's no longer, you can't do that. I mean, if you have same-sex attractions, it's everywhere. How can you sort of ignore it when every time you turn on the TV, there's a gay love scene or two women kissing, or
mm-hmm.
there's talk or gay jokes or faggot jokes or whatever. It's so visible out there
mm-hmm.
that you cannot hide as easily as you could have in former generations.
Mm-hmm.
So it's out there. It's visibility. And it's visible, and furthermore, there's a large amount of acceptance. Good example, if you allowed 12 to 18-year-olds to vote, on same-sex marriage. We would have it. Two-thirds favor same-sex marriage. It's the only age group.
Really?
It's the only age group that's in
favor. Because I was going to ask you about that. If they don't want to be identified as gay, I was thinking, is it correct to think that they might not want to even deal with the fact of gay marriage?
Oh, no, very definitely. Oh,
they
just assume that they will be able to marry someone of their same gender.
Uh-huh.
It's not an issue for them. Their perspective, I think it's safe to say, is it's only a matter of time.
Mm-hmm.
Look, 60% of adults favor either sort of civil unions or marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the youth are just much further along than adults. But already there is that kind of acceptance. So, yeah, they assume they'll be able to partner with someone.
That's fascinating. So most young people don't want to, you know, to link their sexuality to their identity. So what is important in regard to their identity? Did they talk to you about that?
It's the same thing as it would be for, I think, heterosexual kids or other, well, I almost hate to use the word normal kids, but other kids with other sex attractions. And that is that, you know, their career, their writing, mm-hmm. their sports, it's the same thing. I mean, I think the thing that we have to keep in mind is that these kids with same-sex attractions are basically adolescents.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're just, I mean, I almost hate to say it, they're ordinary. They really are.
You say that a lot in your book, right. And you're happy about that.
I am very happy.
Yeah.
And I think by saying ordinary, I'm really trying to say, yes, there are kids who are in trouble with same-sex attractions, and we clearly know those kids, and we read about those kids. And there are clearly kids who are just beginning to be recognized, who are very strong, very resilient, who are leaders in their schools, who are just exceptional individuals. But then that's what you would expect. No matter how you cut up the slice of the adolescent population, you'd expect to find the extremes of good and bad, but most would be in the middle.
Mm.
And that's what these kids are. They're just in the middle with same-sex attractions.
Mm. Let's talk about some of those early studies. You've brought up some of those in your book, in which gay youth are portrayed as troubled and dysfunctional and isolated. I remember some of those studies. Now, do you think some of that was manipulated to fit, you know, whoever was tracking this, their preconceptions, or have things really changed?
Well, I think it's multi-determined. I think clearly initially the only visible kids with same-sex attractions were those who were extraordinarily troubled.
Mm-hmm.
Many had run away from home, were involved in prostitution, were very suicidal. So it would be expected that those kids we would know a lot about. And that took us up through, say, the late 80s, when we began to do a lot more research, began to recruit in better ways, and we began to discover there are a lot of kids who are not that troubled.
Mm-hmm.
Still, we found very high suicide rates. We found some substance abuse. But I will say, and this is a thing we fail to keep in mind, is that even though the rates of suicidality and binge drinking and eating disorders and so forth were higher than heterosexual youth, it still was a minority of youth with same-sex attractions. And that's what we forget, is that the actual, most of them were doing really quite well. So we emphasize, I call, we demonize gay youth, which is interesting to me because it's sort of a process of repathologizing homosexuality, only it's not adults anymore that are pathological, and it's not because of their own inherent nature, it's because of their discrimination and being victimized, these youth. And yet what it strikes me is that the question is like, why did we focus on that? And here I can only speculate, and this is where I get myself into some amount of trouble. But
go for it,
but
Rich.
What the heck? All right. First, I think that many of the people who are doing the research are gay themselves and had extraordinarily difficult adolescence.
Mm.
And I think there was a way in which some dynamic was going on where they could not imagine growing up young and gay and proud. Because themselves.
And it wasn't just a bumper sticker, right, that the kids really are.
Right. And they had very difficult lives. And that's what probably motivated them to be passionate about their research, is that their own difficult adolescence. And let's face it, a second very important factor was that the only way to gain funding for your research, quite frankly, is to find trouble. We do not usually fund research on healthiness. We fund things on problems. And so if you wanted to do research, and a lot of it was in HIV, AIDS-related research grants, and so you just sort of tack on, sexual activity, you tack on binge drinking, you tack on suicidality, and you get a profile that doesn't look very good. The third factor of my speculation is that the early researchers were clinicians and medical professionals. And by definition, they are not looking at normative behavior or populations. Their vested interest by professional design is to look at problems and to identify them and then try to make corrections. Which leads me to sort of what I think it might be the fourth reason, which is simply that a lot of these people were very, very good at heart and they wanted services. And I'll tell you, if you want to get into the public school system, okay, and you want to sort of get in there to do education or you want to do sex ed or any kind of education or support groups, you've got to show, hey, look, these kids are troubled. Mm-hmm. But
you have to admit that things have changed because, I mean, I lived in San Francisco off and on for 17 years, and I did meet kids who had been kicked out and their parents didn't understand and they were being ostracized and so on. So do you think the culture has changed? Are parents not doing that as much? And is there more support so that we aren't seeing so many youth who are destitute and isolated?
Well, I couldn't tell you from a research perspective in terms of proportion. Mm-hmm. I do know those kids are still out there.
Yeah.
But let me be very clear. I think many of the kids who are kicked out of their families and become homeless are not exactly from well-functioning, loving, caring homes. I think most of those kids are already from dysfunctional families. Some of those kids may already have mental illness. Some of those kids may already be borderline in terms of substance abuse, drug usage, and so forth. So my guess is that these are already troubled kids. And I'm not blaming them. I might blame their family somewhat. But I do think that parents get a very bad rep. I think most family members accept their kids, even though it could be delayed.
You are listening to Out of Bounds on WEOS. My guest is Rich Savin Williams, and we are talking about his newly released book, The New Gay Teenager. I want to touch on AIDS. Did you touch on AIDS with any of these young people?
We talked about it, but that was not by any means a focus of the research.
Mm-hmm.
All of them were certainly aware, and when I did speak about it, it scared them very much. Most said that they had every intention to practice safe sex. I didn't follow up on that or to verify that. But it's clearly not as much in their mind's eye as it would be for an earlier generation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've heard that some of the sexual risks are happening again among young people and so on. So I wonder if we might not need more education out there for young people in regard to this issue.
I would think absolutely.
Yeah.
I don't think we can sort of give it up yet.
Did you touch on anything in regard to kids of color? And are there differences between lesbians, young gay men, people of color?
Mm-hmm. Well, clearly, there are very significant differences, and I think that part of it seems especially pertinent for the youth of color who are in fairly religious homes, because many of them felt that there was a very strong family and cultural inhibition or sort of not to go that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so they found it very difficult, I think, in some ways to declare their sexuality, or they felt like it would be very unsafe to do that.
So they weren't being scared off by labels. They literally were afraid to come out in some ways, huh?
I think so. I think there certainly were those young women of color who were very much against the categories and the boxes that they would be placed in.
What do you think parents and friends of gays has done for youth? Do you think that has been part of the sea change in regard to support?
Do you mean the organization?
The organization, which is all over the country.
Right, the PFLAG organization.
Yeah, PFLAG.
I think it's been one of those amazing organizations which we will look back on and think is probably one of the best things that ever happened.
Mm-hmm.
The number of parents who have received support I think is incredible from this organization and parents supporting parents. And I think their political action has been amazing. I think there's a way in which they have a very powerful voice because most identify as heterosexual, who love their children and they want to protect their children. And the power of parents in our country is still very, very strong.
Mm-hmm. Cannot be underestimated. You say to be treated like everybody else, everyone else is the new revolution. Well, let's talk about that. I mean, it sounds almost too optimistic, like there's no more homophobia and discrimination, right. So let's talk about that.
I would not be so naive as to say, oh, good, we're done. Homophobia is over. Uh-huh. Because it clearly exists, and it exists in their schools, and it exists in their peer groups. And I think that many of them recognize that, and almost any young person with same-sex attraction can recount instances in which she or he was abused or victimized or whatever. My only point is that that actually goes across the board. Most kids, regardless of their sexuality, can recall times when they are bullied or teased. Now, what's interesting is that when you take a look at the research, it's only about 5 to 7% of the high school class or junior high school class, which the kids are saying is negative towards them. So what we're looking at is this group of bullies that are harassing kids. They sort of pick and choose. Oh, you know, you're black. Well, I'm gonna bully you on that. Oh, I think you're gay. I'm gonna bully you on that. Mm-hmm. You're a girl. I'm gonna bully you on that. So I think there's this group of kids, and they are bullies, and they harass and they ridicule kids. But I think what's important to keep in mind is that youth with same-sex attractions who have been ridiculed report that 95% of their class is either supportive or neutral. So it's not, I mean, any kind of bullying is an instant too much. But to say that their world is just, you know, covered with all of these horrible individuals who are harassing them, making their life miserable, no, it's one or two individuals who are doing this.
Yeah, I noticed that as I've worked in the schools, too. I mean, I have heard derogatory words still, and I'm still surprised by it, you know? I mean,
right.
But not often does one hear that.
Right. And it is true. Teachers do not stop the words as much as they should, and they should be doing a whole lot more.
Yeah.
And what is beginning to happen, though, is that there are a large number of, I'm not even call them straight allies, because they are not necessarily allies. They just simply think it's inappropriate. And there are kids who are not afraid of being labeled gay simply because they want to stop the bullying and what's going on, you know, in the classroom and so forth.
Are you somebody who's asked to address schools and assemblies and go in and talk to young people?
I have. In fact, just a couple of weeks ago, I went to the Ithaca High School Gay Straight Alliance, and this is very telling for me in some ways, is because I some time ago, maybe 10 years ago, I was involved in trying to start a group, and I think we had one or two people, and the group just couldn't get off the ground. Now, on the other hand, they have 35 to 40 kids at every meeting, and it's just like that's the amount of kids who are now out there willing to go to a meeting, and I don't know what percent of those kids have same-sex attractions, but clearly more than one or two did.
In one of the last chapters of your book, you talk about some of the gay movement's senior statesmen, like historian Martin Duberman and writer Sarah Schulman, and you say that they're skeptical of the rejection of labels, and you go on to make a statement that says, in regard to senior statesmen, but quote, the potential for leading a normal life is not what they want. Their romantic ideal is being transgressive, being the rebel, unquote. Is that a fair statement? Do you really think that some of our foremothers and forefathers don't wish the best for gay youth and want them to continue to...
Well, they wish for the best, but their definition of what is best would vary from my definition or the youth definition. And that is, they do want kids out there marching, fighting for rights. They want the rebellion. They want that kind of turn the system inside out. And there's some, when you read their material, they become almost anti-gay at times. If you're anti-gay and not in the streets, you know, then you're sometimes the insults, and sometimes it just becomes very negative, like those faggots who are safely behind their closed doors.
And trying to pass.
Yes.
I often would get that because I refuse to cut my hair.
Right. Right. There are regulations which we're supposed
to
have.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was incredibly radical and out in the streets and doing all kinds of activism stuff. But I wouldn't cut my hair, so I was trying to pass. So one does get insulted. Also, when you're not endorsing just gay candidates or something, you know, you have to do the party line. So I understand that. What about the future? The future looks bright for gay youth?
Well, I hope it looks so bright that it will go away.
You've said that in your book.
My next book should be The Forgotten Gay Youth. I think it's good. I mean, when I think about when I first got involved in this research, you know, now about 20 years ago, I kept thinking, wouldn't it be great to live in a world in which sexuality didn't matter? That we were just simply whoever we are, you know, I'm, you know, conservative or liberal or feminist or not, whatever, whoever I am, that's who I am. And that you can't know me by my sexuality. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that we are actually getting closer to that ideal. And it feels bizarre to me that people who are very strong activists, who I thought were fighting for that very right, that is that sexuality would not matter, would like this. Now, true, we're not there yet. There are a lot of things that need to be done. Mm-hmm. But I would say for anyone who thinks there hasn't been a major revolution, just take a look, you know, what is true today, and then go back to 1995, 10 years ago. And I could not imagine in 95 where we would be today. I could not imagine writing this book 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Or interviewing youth and saying, oh, yeah, who cares? You know, or, yeah, you want a label for me? Well, I don't want to give you a label. Don't put me in a box.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of people who got sick of being ghettoized, and people did call it ghettoization. Mm-hmm. We had two streets in San Francisco where we could feel safe. Mm-hmm. And, I moved to Amsterdam at some point because I wanted to live in a real world where we were literally everywhere, and therefore we were not visible at all. We were just living our lives. Yes. And so I understand your sentiments, and I agree with you on that. One of the things you said, I hope to see the elimination of same-sex sexuality as a defining characteristic of adolescence in my lifetime. Do you think you will?
Oh, yes.
Absolutely?
Absolutely. And I will be thrilled. I will be out of a job. I'll have to get something else to do research on. But I think that's good. I mean, actually, I think that in the foreseeable future, there will always be a need for organizations and for individuals to push the agenda. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you that, you know, if I had my choice, that is, if today I could get rid of homophobia or I could get rid of sexism, I would get rid of sexism in a second. Hmm. Because I am absolutely convinced that a lot of the feelings of homophobia, homonegativism, is the result of sexism. And I think in our culture, sexism is the much larger battle. Or racism. I mean, when I think about what are the kinds of things that really confront our culture today, you know, classism. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time believing that the number one thing that we ought to put all of our energy into is to try to eliminate homophobia. Mm. In large part, it just strikes me that there will be a lot of individuals throughout time who will have real problems with same-sex sexuality. No matter how much we make it normal or whatever, they're not going to be happy with it.
Thank you so much for being with us, Rich.
Of course. My pleasure.
Out of Bounds is produced by Tim Reppert at Rep Studio in Ithaca. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. If you want to talk to us, you can email us at weos@hws.edu. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.